Our first speaker will be Melissa Oxy Wong, and she is a PhD candidate in music at the University of Cambridge, where she is supported by a Gates Cambridge Scholarship and a Shirk Doctoral Fellowship. She holds an MA in music theory from McGill University and a BA in music with honors from Columbia University. Her dissertation is on cover versions in popular music.
So I should mention before I start that the paper I'm presenting today is based on my field work in Toronto, and I've actually brought one of my research informants with me. He's sitting in the audience, Jeremy Finkelstein. You could just sort of wave so people know who you are. I just thought it would be interesting for all of us to have him here with us so that maybe if you have questions for him as well, he'd be able to help me answer them. Okay. So in recent years, scholars such as Theodore Gratchik, Andrew Kanya, and Alban Zak have argued that the song has been replaced by the track as the primary work of popular music, one that fuses together song, performance practice, and production style as inseparable parts of a single musical work. As the track has taken on this central role in popular music, it has become the standard according to which a live performance is evaluated. Philip Auslander even goes so far as to say that most live performances of popular music now seek to replicate the music on recordings. This turn is epitomized by the emerging trend of historically informed performance practice in popular music, in which tracks are treated as sonic texts to be faithfully recreated in live performance. This practice strives to communicate not only a given song, but also the performance and production styles of a specific recording of that song. Musicians emulate the stylistic and technical aspects of performance, draw on research into the music's historical context of production, and frequently perform with period instruments and audio equipment corresponding to the era or even the exact model of gear used on the original recording. Historically informed performance in popular music therefore has much in common with historically informed performance of Western art music. However, whereas the latter must determine performance practice by reconstructing the aesthetic criteria of a work's original context with the aid of written or notated documents, the former treats the recorded track as concrete evidence of aesthetic criteria for a song's performance. Indeed, acts in this vein are not so much performing songs as they are performing recordings or tracks. This paper explores the trend of historically informed performance in popular music through a study of three Toronto-based event series that specialize in this approach. The first is Loving in the Name Of, a bi-monthly dance party and live set in celebration of the greatest hits of all time, which is what Jeremy Finkelstein helped start. The second is The Big Sound, a spin-off event that focuses exclusively on Motown hits. And the last is Classic Albums Live, a touring concert series that recreates classic pop and rock albums live on the concert hall stage, note for note, cut for cut. Drawing on a year of ethnographic field research, including observations of rehearsals and concerts, in-depth interviews and informal conversations with the musicians involved, and analysis of the event's media coverage, I show how these groups understand the recorded track as a sonic text embedded with evidence of performance practice and production style, and use it to inform their approach to live performance. By treating tracks not as disposable entertainment, but as artworks and historical documents worthy of study and replication, this practice is indicative of the rise of historical consciousness in popular music, which John Myers defines as a symptom of a general tendency to treat rock music seriously as something with aesthetic and cultural merit worth knowing about and understanding. And I'll tell this story in two scenes. Scene one, 12:30 a.m. It's still early for a Friday night. A queue snakes out the entrance of the Great Hall, a historic landmark and vintage venue on a densely built stretch of West Queen Street West in Toronto. Designated Toronto's Art and Design District, this strip is packed with art galleries, boutique hotels, design houses, restaurants, bars, and nightclubs catering to young, creative urban dwellers. Inside the venue, the 3,000-square-foot main floor is standing room only, and the wraparound balcony is littered with attendees leaning on the edge of the sweeping wrought iron railing to get a view of the curtain-lined proscenium arch stage. The hall is a sea of mainly young white professionals in their mid-20s to mid-30s, and the crowd is buzzed, both in terms of excitement and in terms of alcohol intake. They cheer as the band steps onto the stage and launches into an hour-long set of chart hits from a broad spectrum of genres and eras, moving easily from Toto's Africa to Van Halen's Jump to The Cure's Just Like Heaven. Every tune is almost instantly recognizable to this audience, garnering cheers of excitement within the first few notes as the partygoers recall familiar chart hits of years past, unabashedly singing and dancing along to the music. Loving in the Name Of, the event that I have just described, may sound like a familiar scene on the cover band circuit, where bands perform exclusively material previously recorded and released by other artists, rather than their own original material. However, whereas this band does perform cover versions, it differs from a typical cover band in that it's in its focus on historical performance practice, as demonstrated by the musicians' use of the recorded track as a prescriptive text and their attention to the historical details of performance and production. Even the shape of the band itself can change from one show to the next. While the core band consists of co-organizers Jeremy Finkelstein on drums, Christopher Sands on guitar and synthesizer, and Joseph Chavasson on flute, clarinet, saxophone, and synthesizer, as well as Matt McLaren on guitar, Michael Smith on bass, and Francois Turin on guitar, the organizers bring in additional musicians according to the demands of the set list, whether that be a French horn player, a string section, or a 40-person choir for a rendition of You Can't Always Get What You Want by the Rolling Stones. They also draw on a large network of local singers, selecting voices according to the styles and timbres of the singers on the tracks to be performed. In 2001, Loving in the Name Of inspired the spin-off event, The Big Sound, with which it now alternates monthly appearances at the Great Hall. Declaring itself the biggest Motown bash the city has ever seen, The Big Sound offers an hour-long live set of Motown hits performed by a 25-piece orchestra led by Sands, with singers and musicians also chosen based on the needs of the show. The shape of the band is therefore molded according to the material, underscoring the emphasis on successful reproduction of sounds on record. The musicians of Loving in the Name Of and The Big Sound achieved this goal through close attention to performance practice and production style, as communicated through both the recorded track and other historical artifacts that articulate the details of its creation, such as magazine interviews and film footage. The musicians are therefore particularly sensitive to stylistic concerns such as timbre and voicing. Chavasson argues that the more distinctive a timbre, the more prominent it is in the mix, and the earlier it is heard in the track, the more crucial it is to match that timbre exactly. In a sound check, Sands was alarmed to discover that his keyboard patch for Jump, the distinctive and foregrounded first sound on the track, which had matched the timbre of the original exactly in rehearsal, sounded different when played through the venue's speaker system. He then went to great lengths to adjust the patch before the gig so that the audience would be able to identify the tune from the timbre of the very first chord. Likewise, with voicing, the more distinctive and prominent a part, and the earlier it is heard on the track, the more carefully the musicians recreate it in performance. McLaren, who often plays lead guitar, argues that the subtle differences amongst an open chord, a bar chord, or a chord played on a capo or with an alternate tuning can drastically change the character of a song. The stylistic tracings captured on the recorded track therefore function for these musicians both as documentary evidence of historical performance practice and as prescriptive texts for their own performance. The musicians often also turn to historical documents outside of the track for guidance on more technical aspects of performance. For example, they may use film footage of the original performer playing a tune to examine the musician's technique in a particularly complex passage. When Jordan Howard served as guest guitarist on Loving in the Name Of's performance of Jump, to learn the unfamiliar finger-tapping style of the guitar solo, he studied a video of Eddie Van Halen himself playing the solo in order to determine the positions that he used. They also rely regularly on industry magazines or online forums to research the instruments, amplifiers, and effects used on a given track, turning to period equipment or modern-day equivalents to help them recreate the sound. For example, Turin purchased a guitar pedal specifically for gigs with Loving in the Name Of. He says, it does chorus and flange and phaser and all of these sounds that come up in a lot of 70s and 80s music. We do a lot of 80s tunes, so to get that tone is really crucial to the sound. These musicians therefore draw on a wide range of resources to inform their understanding of the original performer's equipment and technique, whether documentary evidence such as video footage, authority-ascribed accounts such as industry publications and artist interviews, or musician folk knowledge as passed on through oral histories and online forums. Moreover, these sources are treated not only as traces of historical music making, but also as treatises on performance practice. Despite their close attention to performance practice and production style, Loving in the Name of and The Big Sound do make small adjustments to adapt the tracks for live performance. Such changes tend to occur at the level of large-scale structure. For example, the organizers may cut out formal sections if a performance feels too long, or change the ending if the track ends in a fade-out. They may also make changes in order to allow the audience time to react. Loving in the Name of extended the instrumental break in its performance of Jump, waiting for the crowd's cheering to die down before starting the song back up again. As McLaren explains, it'll be almost more like the record in a way because it'll be more coherent. In this sense, the goal is not simply to recreate the track, but to recreate the effect of the track by accounting for the audience's specific listening environment in the rock venue. The musicians also take audience expectation into consideration when preparing their performances, knowing that partygoers are far more interested in the overall sound and feel of the performance than in the accuracy of every note. Loving in the Name of and The Big Sound therefore adopt an approach to historically informed performance that takes seriously the recorded track as an artwork and a historical document, while accounting for the nature of listening in the rock venue and recreating the track for live performance. End scene. Scene two, 7:55 p.m. It's getting late, but most of the audience is still milling about the lobby of the concert hall. The five-minute bell rings to alert them that the concert is about to start. Small clusters of Gen Xers and aging baby boomers, some in pairs or on double dates, others with large groups of friends, start to make their way to the auditorium, where the ushers check their tickets, hand them programs, and direct them to their seats. As the lights dim, the audience is reminded to turn off their cellular phones, and the ushers close the doors so that latecomers must wait until an appropriate break in the performance to be seated. The audience waits in silence, breaking into applause and cheers when the musicians walk out on stage. Outfitted in black concert dress and taking their positions behind their respective music stands. The concert begins with the sound of a needle hitting vinyl before the first note is played, leading directly into an uninterrupted performance of Queen's 1975 album, A Night at the Opera, with each track in album order. The audience listens with rapt attention, clapping and cheering enthusiastically after each song, and finally leaping to their feet in a standing ovation once the last note has rung. The lights go up for intermission, and some concertgoers wander over to the gift shop, where they find a selection of Queen albums for sale. When they return for the second half, they're treated to a set of Queen's greatest hits. The atmosphere is now more relaxed, with the performers encouraging the audience to sing or clap along. Some concertgoers even get up from their seat and dance. Imagine that. The format of the evening is more akin to that of a classical recital than a rock concert. But for the choice of music, it really could have been A Night at the Opera, or at least at the symphony orchestra. In reality, this event was part of Classic Albums Live, a concert series founded by Craig Martin in 2003 that takes classic albums and recreates them live on the concert stage, note for note, cut for cut, as per their motto. Classic Albums Live therefore treats not only the individual track, but the entire album as a coherent artistic output embedded with sonic descriptions of performance practice and production style that can be used as a prescriptive text for historically informed performance. The concept started out as a monthly concert series at the Phoenix Concert Theater, an alternative rock venue in Toronto, and has since grown into a touring operation with around 150 performances each year in concert halls across Canada and the United States, including performances in Toronto venues such as Roy Thomson Hall, home of the Toronto Symphony Orchestra, and Massey Hall, a historic theater that has played host to some of the artists whose albums are featured in this series, most famously Neil Young's Live at Massey Hall, 1971. However, concerts more commonly take place in the performing arts centers of smaller cities or suburban towns. By performing on stages that usually host ensembles from literate music cultures, Classic Albums Live aims to elevate popular music to the same level of cultural capital ascribed to these musics. Martin makes this connection explicit when he says, "This is like a rock and roll recital. We're treating music the same way that the Toronto Symphony Orchestra treats Mozart." Similarly to Loving in the Name Of and The Big Sound, Classic Albums Live employs both a core group of musicians who perform regularly with the ensemble and a cast of additional musicians who appear according to the demands of the set list. In order to achieve congruence with the recorded track in performance and production style, historical proficiency is, of course, expected, but musicians are chosen primarily for their synergy with the material. When hiring musicians, Martin looks for the DNA factor, that sublime quality in their playing that says they've either grown up with this music or that it resonates with them in some profound way. Indeed, for Martin, intimate knowledge of the music trumps technical ability as a selection criterion. He says, "I get emails daily from musicians who say, I can play anything, but those aren't the guys I usually get in touch with. It's the guy who phones me up and says, listen, I've been a fan of Pink Floyd's David Gilmour my whole life. I've gotten this particular foot pedal, and I've had the pickups changed on my guitar, and this is an album that I would love to take part in." This level of attention to the matching of musician and material means that Martin may even assign multiple musicians to a single part on an album. For example, in Classic Albums Live production of A Night at the Opera, in which the role of Queen's lead singer, Freddie Mercury, is divided amongst four singers, two male and two female. The musicians' abilities are therefore most valorized when they're willing to subordinate their identities to that of the music being played, much as classical musicians do with their repertoire. Further, they are expected to inform the stylistic and technical aspects of their performance with their knowledge of the music's aesthetic criteria and cultural context. The musicians flesh out their approach with research into the technical aspects of the original performance, drawing again both on the recorded track and extant knowledge about its production history. They're meticulous in their preparation, studying the music, researching the production techniques, purchasing period instruments or equipment in their efforts to recreate the album live on stage. Similar to Loving in the Name Of's Turenne, one guitarist for Classic Albums Live even ordered a foot pedal from the 70s that he had managed to find online in order to recreate one of the sounds from Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon. As Martin describes it, the musicians have a lot of homework, and they go from complete elation to complete panic. They study the albums. Some of them chart it, and some listen to the record and learn how to play it again. They research the instruments, and they also research the type of tunings that went into it. Both the album or the track itself and other sources of technical knowledge, such as industry publications or simple word of mouth within the music community, function for these artists as evidence of historical performance practice and prescriptive documents for how this music should be recreated in live performance. With this emphasis on the successful reproduction of sonic events on record, Classic Albums Live aims to create not the mere effect of the track or album, as with Loving in the Name Of and The Big Sound, but an exact replica of it in live performance, even when the aesthetic criteria of recording conflicts with the aesthetic criteria of live performance. For example, the group recreates audio effects such as fade-outs with the assistance of the sound engineer, a jarring and unnatural effect in a live setting. In fact, if you simply closed your eyes and listened, you might imagine that a needle had in fact dropped on an actual record and that it were being projected into the concert hall. Whereas Loving in the Name Of and The Big Sound adapt their performances to faithfully recreate not the track itself, but the effect of the track in the listening environment of the rock venue, Classic Albums Live offers an unstraying recreation of the album in its performance practice, instead asking audiences to adjust their expectations and apply their listening strategies for recordings to live performance. Through these three examples, Loving in the Name Of, The Big Sound, and Classic Albums Live, I've shown how a growing emphasis on the recorded track as the primary output of popular music has contributed to the rise of historically informed performance in popular music, a practice that regards the track both as a sonic text embedded with evidence of historical performance practice and production style, and as a prescriptive document on how to recreate the music in live performance. By taking tracks seriously as aesthetic and cultural products, historically informed performance testifies to the importance of the music being recreated and reflects a broader trend in popular music to commemorate music of the past through the contrivances of the nostalgia industry, such as album reissue projects, greatest song lists, and popular music museums. This rise of historical consciousness is indicative of a growing tendency to treat popular music as worthy of critical attention and is a trend that is worth taking as seriously as the music itself. Thank you.
Okay, just that last phrase that you were arguing, I'm really interested because you you're saying this is a part of a phenomenon of popular music in general being treated more seriously. And so I'm wondering if it's popular music in general or if it's classic rock in general or something more narrow.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
That brings up the question that I really want to ask, which is about the experience of appraisal in these productions. What kinds, and either of you could answer this, I guess, but what kinds of decisions are made in terms of what will qualify for a concert like these? I imagine some really fascinating arguments
going on. Well, I could answer your question sort of about the culture industry and about the phenomenon of, you know, whether it's popular music or classic rock that's being taken more seriously. But I think I'll direct the question about how choices of repertoire are chosen for these concerts to Jeremy, if that's okay with you. Okay, so yes, I do absolutely agree that predominantly, as the popular music industry has started taking these cultural products more seriously, it has been primarily classic rock of the 60s, 70s, and 80s that's been elevated to this level of standard, sort of like new standards of rock music. And I think that largely has to do with, you know, simply who is writing these histories, who are the people in control of these industries. And I mentioned briefly in this paper the work of Jonathan Paul Myers, who writes about, it's actually his term that I use, the rise of historical consciousness in popular music. And basically he links it to the phenomenon of the baby boomers, the fact that there was this generation of people who really did conceive of themselves as a unique generation and who use age as a way of defining themselves as a social category instead of these, instead of things like race or gender or geography. And this was a very new way of thinking about, social categories. It is the fact that they were in a very unique position, that there was such a preponderance of them that they took up 40% of the population of the United States at the time of their adolescence, and that they had so much cultural and economic power that the histories of popular music that we have are, in fact, really histories of classic rock. So I hope that answers the first part of your question. And Jer, can you tell us a little bit about how you make your choices of what songs to perform?
Sure. For the most part, it has to do with popularity. In terms of popularity, I mean, classic rock is, we play basically anything that's popular, and we're touching on hip hop, R&B, 90s R&B, hip hop. Probably the age range is probably 25 to 40 in our audience. So, and that's also the age range of the band. So, if there's three people involved, we Joseph Travison and Christopher Sands. Basically, it's very aggressive, and it's, you can just imagine, whenever you have three people, three people have to like the same song. Three people have to think that this song is popular, that everyone knows it. It's a business, so the audience will be happy if everyone knows the song, they grew up with it, and they have a connection to it. So, this one person, Mr. Sands, he's a very aggressive, mean person who comes to the like destroy everything. An example, I want to play Nirvana in Bloom. Song I like, and he thought it was a horrible song, and he thought Kurt Cobain, he was the first one towards Kurt Cobain, and it was just absurd. When it comes down to the other two people, all we care about is having fun. So, as far as picking goes, yeah, it's first of all the three things. And we like them, and then popularity we discussed well, everyone knows.
Yeah. Jer, I thought it was interesting that you specifically mentioned the word business, because in the interviews that I did with almost everyone who I talked about in this project, that was one of the key motivators for performing covers specifically in this way, was that people really like listening to songs that they know, and not just the songs, they want them to sound like they did on record. And the best way to appeal to them was by treating this not just as, this is a gig where we have fun, of course, but we also want to make money off of it. And the best way to do that is by picking records that really are popular.
But this falls to your business question and your point there. And it's the involvement, perhaps, of record companies or majors or rights holders in all of it. I can imagine for classic albums live, you say they're selling clean albums in the lobby afterwards. There must be some involvement. Because for the majors, I mean, a lot of their money is now in back catalog.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I wonder if that's part of what's motivating the classic albums. And then for the loving of the name of, I mean, is it just under Spokane rights, or is there some sort of integration with what songs and who is going to be? And your copyright's such a big issue for rights, but they're not making money off new bands. They're making money off what they already own, and they don't want to miss any opportunity.
Absolutely. Like, I definitely think that, you know, this historical consciousness that we have in popular music is in part generated by the popular music industry itself, wanting to make money not by taking a risk on new artists, but on selling us the same material that we've had in the past, but in different formats or remastered or whatever the case may be. So, Jer, do you want to talk a little bit about sort of the copyright issues? I don't know if you've had to deal with it or if the Great Hall takes care of that.
Well, not with the Great Hall. We were at the Gladstone Hotel before the Great Hall, and they were pretty legitimate. And when I came to them, they asked that I paid, I think it was around $50 towards Spokane, because I wasn't playing covers, and we were successful enough that they made a lot of money at the bar that they waived it. I don't know. I can't answer if they decided to pay $50 or you know, if they don't, they won't do it themselves. But that was my experience with Spokane, but we're not paying Spokane in any way, and that's illegal. yeah, and we have no connection to sales or. We're not selling, you know, classic albums, but more of a machine. And I didn't know about them selling Queen in the lobby.
Just what you were talking about with the venue and how they sort of waived this fee once they realized that they were making a lot of money from you at the bar. Maybe you want to tell this story yourself, but I just remember, you know, talking to you and to Joseph, how you were both telling me that these venues that you, so, you know, Loving in the Name of started at a much smaller venue. I think it was the Rec Room in the Annex, which is this really small, disgusting venue. And they've grown up into this, like, large historical venue that has a maximum capacity of 600 people. So repeatedly outgrowing the venues that they've been hosted at, and they've always been asked to come back, and a large part of that is because they are playing these very popular tracks that people want to hear. And because people are having such a good time, there's this sort of safe environment of knowing exactly what you're going to expect, exactly what the band's going to sound like. They are sort of in this party mode, and they do make a lot of money at the bar off of their audience.
I'm wondering, especially the case of Classic Albums Live, that all of these seem pretty institutionalized, and they provide a sort of a new set of structures of opportunity for musicians in the area. I'm wondering, what kind of employers are these? What kind of wages they pay? Are the musicians in their contracts? I mean, our focus here is labor. What are the conditions of people who are working in these scrutinized systems as well?
Jer, I don't know how much you want to disclose about that.
in the case of Loving the Name Up, the musicians are all within the indie Toronto music scene. Some of them play with big acts and probably deal with Spokane more and get proper wages, but it's friends, musicians, we're paying them out. We have wages that we think are fair for each musician for the amount of work they're doing. So this is all this money is under the table. And if you want to know the wages of the band, if you were to calculate the amount of time they spend, because it's very specific, some people, they're trying to match sounds. If we're talking about the song, as far as the sonic rhythm, percent upwards, 50% is the percent speaking about who is quite mean, is the most adamant in getting the right sound. And he once spent 11 hours finding the sound for, I think it was half of SOF. So he's one of the organizers, but just to give you an idea, I've spent upwards to 30 or 40 hours. And I'm sure some people who I've hired also spent that much time in the meeting, $250. So I don't know the math here. So I think it's, depending on the song you choose, that would affect how many hours they would work. But I would say that hopefully making minimum. But they're friends and we're having fun. There's very much a fun factor. Classic album, again, takes more of this machine.
Yeah.
I would imagine they're working legally. Well,
thank you very much, Teresa.
Thank you. Thanks, Jer.